Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today I have a special guest, Wayne Jett, joining the program. And we are going to be talking about the Great Depression, many of the facts that you've never learned in school, the public is completely unaware of. We're going to be talking about the events leading up to the Depression and throughout the Great Depression. And this is a two-part episode. And he actually comes back and does a couple more episodes with me as well, which is going to lead up to the 2008 crash and what's going on today. But this is really fascinating. Many, many facts that I am sure you have not heard before. So I recommend that you listen to this whole episode and maybe listen to it again. Go to sarahwestall.com, listen to it, buy his book. It's called Fruits of Graft, and you can get it on amazon.com. Really highly recommend it. So let's get into this interview now with Wayne Jett. Hi, Wayne. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Sarah. It's a great pleasure.
Well, you have been highly recommended to me on economics, how the Great Depression actually came to be, and what kind of economics we had and philosophies before and after and up through some of our latest 2008, you know, dilemmas and where we are and now. We're not going to be able to get through all that in today's interview, I'm so happy that you agreed to come back and do a couple sessions with us so that we can really get to some of these key things that you have written about and done so much work on. Can you explain a little bit about yourself and your background and also the book that you wrote?
Well, I'd be happy to. I was educated. My basic degree was engineering from the University of Oklahoma. Then I got a law degree. I practiced law for 30 years or so in Southern California, the Los Angeles area, and went to the Supreme Court a couple of times and argued several dozens of cases that were published in the Ninth Circuit on appeal, and basically also did business work and that sort of thing. But as of about the year 2000, I moved out of that field. I ended my legal practice and wanted to go into the financial sector, partly to try to preserve whatever assets I had left, because things were not going so well about then. That was around 2000 and the so-called tech crash. And I had begun studying classical economics and finding out from those in the economic field what I could and what I could agree with and what I couldn't. And I began working with Jude Winiski and his firm Polyeconomics, which I still consider to have been the best economic forecasting firm in the United States for the last 25 years of the 20th century. A very capable man, and yet he did not have a degree in economics. He learned it otherwise from tutoring from established economists who essentially practiced what I understand to be classical economics. Most people these days think that we never knew anything about economics until John Maynard Keynes came along with Keynesian economics in the 1930s, 1935-36. I would say the fact is that the opposite of that is true. That is, Keynesian economics has been created to obfuscate, to confuse, to make things much harder, and basically to cover up the real motives of those who are enacting and carrying out economic policy. What had been the case before Keynes and during the Great Depression is that the world honored what is called classical economic theory. It's what made the middle class grow. It was the reformed economic governmental policy that came out of England, Europe, and so forth in the days in which mercantilism was finally being overcome by the aspirations of the middle class.
Well, can you talk about a few things? Can you talk about what is the difference between classical economics and Keynesian? And also, since you brought up mercantilism, can you explain what that is? Because in your book, you talk about the fact that the United States from 1600 to 1900 and in the Middle Ages in Europe was based on that system. So we
yes.
need to before we go into too much details, I was hoping you could kind of explain those three concepts to everybody.
I'll be happy to do that. Mercantilism is a really respectful, genteel term or name that was given to a system that basically is what I would call kingmaking, in which the most powerful people in a given geographic area would get together and put a king on the throne to rule the country. And then they basically would influence him and tell him what to do in order to make themselves richer. That was what was genteelly called mercantilism, to make it sound as if it were just a business, like a mercantilist selling clothing and things of that sort. But it was really kingmaking. And the principles that it followed included such things as trade wars and real wars. The long wars between Europe and France and so forth and so on were wars between the ruling elites of those countries, trying to get the better of each other and trying to make sure that they came out richer so that they could have bigger armies and could maintain their power and existence and so forth. Now, that lasted for hundreds of years, and those families became not poorer but wealthier. They were very successful at it, but somehow the middle class got a foothold as people began to get the idea that they could do something other than just work for the king. They started struggling for political rights, the Magna Carta, and the various rights of man that were developed through England and the English people, the French people, and their struggle for prosperity in the face of continuing impoverishment and slavery. All of that came to the fore in the studies of people such as Adam Smith, who was in Scotland, University of Glasgow, David Hume, and others of that ilk, particularly began writing and looking at what policies of government would be better for economic growth. What could they argue that would make the king stronger, more wealthy, and therefore get some support from the king, as opposed to just making his friends and supporters wealthy at the expense of everyone else. That's what developed from Adam Smith as a primary advocate of it. He wrote a couple of books, including the one so well known called The Wealth of Nations in 1776. Came out at the same time as the American Declaration of Independence. And it was called, even later, Keynes called it, the theory of the firm. That is, looking at economic ideas or public policy ideas from the viewpoint of what policy would make it easier or better for the ordinary person to support himself, to start a business, to hire people. To be generally prosperous. And it was those ideas that resulted in Adam Smith's books that became very influential in the British Parliament. And in fact, the leader of the British Parliament after 1776 was a great supporter And it was that kind of policy that started supporting more free trade among nations and allowing all nations to prosper as opposed to simply the ones that could win the wars. And so that became the guiding light of politics throughout the 1800s, particularly after the Battle of Waterloo in 1815, and both the U.S. and Great Britain began to prosper with this classical economic theory, the theory of the firm.
Well, can you break down, you've told us a couple elements of classical economics. Can you break down kind of the general, some other general ideas of classical economics?
Yes, I'll be happy to. Number one, the primary principle of it is that from a monetary standpoint, the money that you have in your economy needs to be designed to be stable in value. The main thing you want is a money or currency whose value does not change. If it changes, it makes it very difficult for business to price its goods.
And explain why that is, because if it goes up, explain the difference in, you know, when it goes
yes.
up and down, and why is it so difficult for businesses in the community to handle those fluctuations?
Okay, let's take inflation. That's when the value of the money goes down, it loses value, and therefore the prices go up. What you have to do when that happens is that every person in the world who does any kind of business, whether it's labor or whether it's selling a product or making a product or what, they have to change their prices every day or they lose money. And it is a very inefficient thing to do. When you have to reprice that much, it takes a lot of your time, and so you lose efficiency. But on the other hand, if the value, if the money gains value, which is called deflation, it means that, even worse, you have to lower your prices in order to sell your product. Otherwise, because the money is more valuable than it was when you were paying for the production, your goods won't sell. So you simply go out of business one way or the other because, number one, if you don't lower your prices, you can't sell your goods. If you do lower your prices, you lose money, and therefore you go bankrupt. That is exactly what happened during the 1870s, when we had what was called the most prolonged, the longest economic contraction in U.S. history, was in the 1870s, when there was a deflation that was caused by a law of Congress enacting a law that said the dollar is going to go back to the value of that it had before the Civil War, and it's going to go back to that value in 1879, which was 6 or 7 years ahead. So during those 6 or 7 years, even though the Civil War was over, the country was growing, it had bankruptcies everywhere, because everybody sold goods that they had to lower the price on, and they lost money and went out of business. So that's the problem with money that is unstable.
Okay, well, so in that particular situation, did they have to do anything, or did the process just work itself out once all that stuff resettled at that new dollar value? That's when the Depression ended?
Yes, it was. It ended right at that time, and we resumed economic growth in the 1880s, but there was still a public policy at the time that was, again, largely mercantilist because the powers behind the government were the ones influencing U.S. government. That was so in 1880, right at the time that Depression ended. I might tell you that during the process of writing my book, it was practically a miracle. I happened to put my hand on a book in the library in Pasadena, California, that I'd never heard of before. I'd never heard of the author before. And it turned out to be by far the highest selling book on economics in history, except that it was between 1880 and 1900. In those 20 to 25 years, that book was called Progress and Poverty. It was by far the largest selling book in economics ever. To this day, it sold more than 2 million copies of the book in those 25 years. And it is perhaps the best written book I've ever read. But the author's name, I would be surprised if you've ever heard it. I had not before finding that book.
What is his name?
His name is Henry George. And 100 years after he published that book, and by the way, he had to self-publish because no publisher in New York would publish it. He was a newspaper man from California, but he had, I think, a brain trust that worked with him. It almost seems like it had to be the case because the book was so exquisitely written. I'm still amazed by it. But in any event, in those 20 years, he became not only known by people for the first time, he became the second or third most highly respected man in the U.S. As a result of that book. It was a book in which he explored the question, why is it that in the richest places in the country, we have right next to it the most severe poverty? And that's what he had experienced in visiting New York City for a period of time when he was trying to establish a wire service for his California newspaper. And he was so shocked by it that he undertook studies of his own to try to learn the question or the answers. And many people are convinced that he learned the answers, but they were so unpopular with the establishment that they were buried.
And so what were the answers that he said?
Essentially, what he determined, he set right a number of the theories of finance and economics that had been so wrong. One was Thomas Malthus, and that overpopulation caused poverty. He showed that was a complete farce and completely wrong. It's still, though, by the way, honored by the ruling elite. But nevertheless, what he found in essence is that in order to produce wealth, it's necessary that man have land, and that policies relating to land have basically allowed land to be cut off from the ordinary person and monopolized by either the king or those who put government on the throne. And in that circumstance, people are kept away from land. They, by the ones who control the land, basically they pay labor only the minimum amount necessary to allow labor to exist. That keeps labor impoverished, and all of the profits from the wealth that is created by the labor on the land is taken and assumed by those in power. And he had an ingenious way of solving the problem. And it was so ingenious that 100 years after his book was self-published, Milton Friedman, in an interview in 1979, said that the least objectionable tax ever designed was the one proposed by Henry George in 1879. The proposal that Henry George made was that you simply, the government simply needs to collect only one tax. One tax only would support the government completely, and that would be a tax equal to the fair rental value of undeveloped land. All of the undeveloped land within the jurisdiction of the government. You would not tax the any improvements on the land. You would tax only the value of the raw land. And on that basis, it would make certain that no one would buy up land and hoard it to keep it away from people who would be productive with it and gain that way. I could spend a good deal of time on why that is so ingenious, but nevertheless, I would say that one of the things disclosed in that book, right towards the end, after he's gone through all of these things of showing the errors in the ways that society was being taught what the problems were and what was causing poverty, he wrote a paragraph towards the end of his book, and he says that the reason what I have told you in this book is not well known is because that societies are led in all the wrong ways. They're taught all the wrong ideas in order to keep them from finding this out, even though it's simple. And he says the reason for this is that it's purposely done because society is controlled by a very powerful pecuniary force that writes our laws and governs us in such a way as to make sure that we don't find out. In other words, in 1880, when he published his book, it was so popular right off the bat that he got a New York publisher as of 1880, and it went off from there. But in that book, he said, you know, as of 1880, he clearly stated that there is a hidden power behind the throne of our governments, including in the United States, of course. Even though we so supposedly are government of the people are chosen and selected and put in office by those behind the throne, just as they were in Europe. You see, we still are called a capitalist society, even though capitalism is the arch enemy of mercantilism. Capitalism was the system designed by the middle class to allow it to compete so that it could compete with the powers that were already extremely wealthy and were controlling the economy of Europe. Capitalism was designed in order to allow individuals who were not wealthy to raise enough capital to compete with the major organizations that the mercantilists already had. Therefore, from the beginning, capitalism has been the arch enemy of the mercantilists.
Well,
And we had.
do the elites know they are specifically strategically oppressing everyone, or are they blindly following strategies that match their best interests, which results in widespread oppression?
Well, the elitists at the top, the ones who control, and do so through a system, a network system, a pyramid system, in which they have many levels of others who serve their purposes and follow their instructions. Those at the top certainly know what they're doing. In my book, I don't do it until towards the end of it, chapter 17. I hold back the story of the manifesto that was written on behalf of the ruling elite and published in 1901. This would have been 21 years after the publication of Henry George's book, in which he spoke about this hidden giant pecuniary force that writes all laws of every nation, not just the U.S., every nation. In the circumstance of in the 1901 book,
The
it was a book,
manifesto.
yes, the Manifesto was a book written by the English author H.G. Wells. It was clearly something that had been, the information had been provided to him by the ruling elite for him to be their, in effect, their scribe, their somebody to put it out in written form. Up until then, H.G. Wells had written basically horror stories and science fiction. This was his first book of nonfiction. It was a small, short book. Basically, it's called Anticipations. It had a longer title, but basically, the longer title said was Anticipations of the Reactions of Society to Mechanization and Progress. And in it, he lays out what the ruling elite really think about the way society is being organized and conducted. In a series of chapters, basically says that this whole thing of democracy is a great gray mass that is oppressing those who are entitled to rule. That the traditional means of ruling society was that there was a class of rulers and a class of the ruled, those who serve. That two-class society was much better, much more stable. Now we have this intervening class called the middle class that is getting in our way and actually contending that it is entitled to have some say in how they are governed. They are burgeoning so much, they are becoming so great that if they're allowed to go any farther, this could get out of hand and we'll never be able to go back to where we were. So we've got to do something about it now. And therefore, they laid out what was to be done. H.G. Wells said that the ascendant nations by the year 2000 must have learned by then how to poison the masses so as to get rid of all those who are unnecessary. He went on at quite some length with other aspects of how this was to be done. He said that there was to be formed a shadow government, not only for the United States, but for every nation in the world, and that that shadow government would devise and implement policies through the existing government in such a way as to be undetectable in their influence, but to have the effects that in the final analysis, the government of the people would crumble and fall into the arms of the shadow government, which they gave it a name. The shadow government was named the New Republic.
So who are the members of the New Republic?
Well, they described specifically in Wells' book the nature of the person who would be the men of the New Republic. The way they described them was that they would be men. They didn't mention women, but they said they would be men who had a sense of being that what was moral would be whatever that person wished to do for his own empowerment. That is, that you're supposedly a person of God, and therefore he's made you to think as you do, and therefore anything that you think and wish and desire is God's desire, and therefore everything by definition that you need to do or want to do for your own empowerment is God's will, and that is your morality. So you may poison, you may kill, you may starve, you may impoverish everyone, and that is the kind of person that we want to be in a position to take full power.
So how do we know that the Republic was formed and that it's working and active now?
Well, I've given you that. I think if we go into that in a great deal, which I'm happy to do, we're going to have some difficulty getting to the Great Depression.
Okay, well then
But let me say to you before we wind up to follow up on that. As I said, H.G. Wells was not very well known at all until that little book. It made him a rock star in the intellectual communities of both Europe, Britain, and the United States. He was invited to the White House as the honored guest on the arm of U.S. American intellectuals to the White House of Theodore Roosevelt. Not long after the book came out. And when he left Teddy Roosevelt's White House, he said, this is the human demigod of whom I have dreamed. That is, he's speaking of Teddy. That is the kind of reception that he got, not only from Teddy Roosevelt, but also from Franklin. He was invited to Franklin Roosevelt with Franklin and Eleanor multiple times for extended stays. He had even higher praise, that is, H.G. Wells praised Franklin Roosevelt even more highly than Teddy, that this is a man that is truly able to lead the world in a way that is always revolutionary but never provokes revolution. That is, he's changing it exactly the way we want it, but nobody ever rises up against him. He makes people think that whatever he does is really in their interests. So that's the kind of thing that they were able to succeed in doing, and it shows very much the case that this is the kind of power that was very active in the United States as well as other parts of the world at the time of the 1920s and the 1930s, which, of course, the 1930s, the Depression, is what we're going to focus on today.
Well, we'll have you back, and then we can dive into the shadow government and answer the questions of why you think the Republic was formed and why you think it's on today. so we can get some of that information out. But I want to ask you a question so we can get into the depression. You summarized in your book that 1900 to 1929 was nearly the best of times. And then in 1929, it abruptly changed the equation. Can you tell us what happened? Why was it the best of times? And why was the equation abruptly changed?
Well, very good question. And let me put it this way. One of the things that's important to understand is that because classical economics had been debated so vigorously, both in Europe and the United States, the general public was very economically literate back then. I mean, who would buy 2 million copies of any book of economics today? How would you sell it? And yet, most people today just assume that in those early years, people were really ignorant. They really had no idea what was going on. They didn't learn anything about economics until John Maynard Keynes came along in the mid-30s. Well, just the opposite is true. In fact, John Maynard Keynes and his father, each of them, their careers were spent teaching classical economics at Cambridge University in England. John Maynard Keynes's father was a revered professor of classical economics at Cambridge during his career. Then the son came along and did the same, was the champion of classical economic theory. The public at large was very well informed about the need for stability in money. You understand that in 1828, the U.S. presidential election was basically turned upon whether we should or should not have a central bank privately owned. That was the first election of Andrew Jackson, the first Democratic Party candidate to be elected president. And his platform was to end the central bank that was then existing, that it was fleecing the people of the country, that it was the worst thing we could do for our economic growth and prosperity. And he won that election in 1828 on the basis that he would end the central bank when its charter expired in 1832. He had to run for re-election again. Actually, it expired in 1833. He had to run for re-election again in 1832, and he won in a landslide on that basis when he was opposed at every step of the way by the cartel, by the ruling elite that owned that central bank. So the entire 1800s were run politically based upon economic issues that were in front of the public. The public back then was very well informed about the importance of money that was stable in value and also plentiful. And so we get back to the early 1900s. And remember, in 1900, we did not have the Federal Reserve. We had no central bank. We had gotten out of that contraction of 1880. There were problems caused by both parties in the 1880s and 90s because of high tariffs. Even though the Democratic Party was anti-tariff, high tariffs interfered with economic growth. But 1900, there had already been economic growth after the Civil War. Strong economic growth, even with bad policies. But during the 1900 to 1930, we averaged growth of what we would call now GDP. The economic growth rate on the average for those 30 years was 6% a year. We haven't come close to that in more recent years. And so, yes, those were very good times, and they were particularly very good times after we got through the war, which again was World War I, was another contrived, orchestrated war by the ruling elite. And we'll have to get into that at a different time, but we come to 1920, And Wilson, who had double-crossed his own electorate, the Democrats had elected him on the basis of no central bank and no graduated income tax, and he double-crossed them on both issues because he had been bought and paid for by the ruling elite. In 1913, his first year in office, he signed both into law, the Federal Reserve and the graduated income tax. And by the time he left office, we not only had a graduated income tax, but the top rate had been increased from, it had started out at 5%, and by the end of the war, it was above 50%.
But he also said, he had the quote, that he unwittingly ruined his country, or something to that effect. Yes.
Yes, yes. He had great regrets, and I believe he was disabled and made incapable of being president, for his trouble by making such a statement. But nevertheless, that's what we had, and as a result, Republicans were reelected to office in 1920, that election. And on the basis of a return to normalcy, which means reducing those income tax rates and maybe even not having an income tax again. So
it went from 0 to 50% in a period go ahead.
Yes, in a period from 1913, when it started at 5%, that was the end of 1913. It might have even been higher than 50%. I don't have it right on the tip of my tongue, but it was very high by that time. And as a result, the newly elected president's first proposal was to reduce the tax rates. Congress was so dominated by the ruling elite that Congress refused to do it the first year, the president was able to get a small tax rate in the second year, tax cut, I mean, and then that president mysteriously died, and the presidency was taken over by the vice president, Calvin Coolidge, who would have appeared to be another establishment man, but he and the Treasury Secretary, who was definitely a very wealthy man of the establishment, Mellon, those two together, Calvin Coolidge made a historical speech to the New York financial community, in which he basically laid out the case for supply-side economics. That is, the case that if you lower tax rates, you'll actually get in more money and the economy will grow faster. That was essentially the Calvin Coolidge speech of, I think it was 1923. And they were able to persuade Congress to start cutting tax rates, which produced every year from then on until Coolidge left office at the end of 1928, it produced a surplus in the budget. Growing revenues and increasing economic activity. That happened every year from Calvin Coolidge's election in his own right in 1924, all the way through 1928, a budget surplus each year and a tax cut. He got the top rate down to 25%.
Can you explain why the elites would want higher taxes?
Because it is an income tax on earned income. The hallmark, the identification of the middle class is you work for a living. You work for your income. That is earned income. This is an income tax on earnings of the middle class. People think that middle class just means those who just have middle income. No. The middle class is the class between the ruling elite and the slaves. They're the ones who work and support themselves, but they include, most very importantly, the upper middle class, the ones who do very well, the ones who start companies, the ones who develop new products, the ones who sell to the world market. All of those are middle class, and they earn income, and they are the ones who are taxed. The ruling elite simply were allowed the out of being able to put their fortunes into so-called tax-exempt trusts. By all indications, although it's secret, they have complete control of all of their money, but they are not taxed on it. They are not paid. They do not pay income taxes on their earnings. It's all tax-exempt. Those are the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, so forth and so on, the Fords, the ones with the major fortunes. Of course, although Rothschilds are believed to be primarily in Europe, their man in the United States was J.P. Morgan. Rockefeller was another who was financed by the Rothschilds. But they became so big, they became, over a period of decades, they became competitors to the Rothschilds, but they are certainly still in the same gang.
Okay, so now does the tax money that is paid in by the middle class, is that viewed as money the elites can use because they control the government?
Well, they certainly do a lot of stealing from it. I mean, certainly, look at these past 8 years with the Obama administration, or you could say the same thing about the Bushes.
Well, and this is something I really want to get into, and we're struggling to get past this whole depression, but when we get you back, I really want to talk about the recent years and what has gone on recently.
Well, do I have a little bit of time to talk about what was actually done in the Great Depression
Yes.
to make the Great Depression happen?
We have about 10 minutes.
All right. Well, I think, in all honesty, that's not going to do it, but I'm happy to at least start it. Herbert Hoover was elected with the highest esteem of any president ever among the American people. They thought he was the best able person ever elected to be president. He had been a world-class engineer and made his fortune that way. He actually worked for it. But he was a Mr. Fix-It on everything, and he was also a Republican nominee, and the Republican Party at that time certainly was an establishment party. Frankly, both of them were. From 1880, the ruling elite decided they had to control both parties, and they did. The ruling elite's plan was to smash the middle class, and Hoover ruled over for that and let it happen. He did three things that he knew were wrong. One is he allowed Smoot-Hawley tariffs to be enacted, and he knew that was wrong. Within 18 months of the time he signed the bill, we had lost right at 70% of our exports and imports business.
Can you continue this? I have another 45 minutes to an hour. Can we just continue this and turn it into two shows and then have you back to do the rest of it?
I'd be happy to do so.
Okay, let's do that. Okay, keep going.
All right. Okay, the first thing he did, as I said, was allow a Smoot-Hawley tariff, a major increase in tariffs that started a trade war the world over. He made it impossible. The tariffs rates were so high, other countries could not sell into the United States any longer, and we were a major market for them at that time. Also, other countries depended more on international trade than we did. Relatively, it was only 7 or 8% of our economy. For other countries in Europe, for example, it was 25% or more of their economy. And so when we shut them out of our country, it put the world into a depression just on that basis. Within 18 months of the time Hoover signed the Smoot-Hawley tariff, unemployment was at 30% and higher in the United States. The other thing that, the second big wrong is that it was well understood at the time that the crash of 1929 was orchestrated. It was characterized by great criminality in the trading of stocks. That kind of trading continued from the it was before the crash, but the crash happened, and then it continued all through the Hoover 4 years, and he did zero about it. People in the public were screaming, "You got to stop the criminality. They're ripping everybody off. They're stealing our capital that we've invested in the stock market." He did nothing about it. That's number two.
And who was stealing it?
The financial moguls of Wall Street. A prime example, for example, with Joseph P. Kennedy, the father of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Teddy Kennedy. He was one of the major operators of Wall Street in the 1920s. As I describe in my book, on October 29th, one of the worst lows of the great crash of 1929, on October 29th, 1929, he was described as sitting on top of the world because he had been selling short, and I would say undoubtedly selling what's called naked short now. They called it then just watering stock. You sell stock that you don't own. You sell it by the millions of shares. It crashes the value or the price of the stock. It drives everybody else to sell. And then you buy again at the bottom and cover your the stock that you sold short. And then you ride it back up. And then you do the same thing again. That happened on 4 or 5 days of that great depression, of that great crash. And it was all done on a signal, as was found in the research of the man I worked with, Jude Winiski. Jude Winiski had published a book in 78 that for the first time identified that each time the stock market fell in October of 1929, it was because there was a vote on the floor of the U.S. Senate to advance Smoot-Hawley as a major tariff increase. I think it wasn't just the fear of what the tariffs would do. It was an agreed-upon signal among the big manipulators on the stock market, the big financial people. They understood that to be the signal that when there's a vote that approves the higher tariffs, you short the market and make it crash. They did that. And were extremely successful beyond their dreams of it. After that great crash, Joe Kennedy, although he had been a major player, he was a really major player after that. He really made his great fortune at that time. And by the time he died in the 1960s, after JFK had been elected president, his fortune was in the well, it was said to be in the neighborhood of 600 million or thereabouts. I think it was substantially higher than that. In any event, those are two of the first two things that Hoover did. The third thing that he did that he knew was wrong, here we were in the jaws of a tremendous depression in 1932. And what does he propose in the year that he's to be run for re-election? That we have a major increase in income tax rates. The Democrats were happy to give him that because they then had control of Congress. They passed an income tax increase that quadrupled the lowest rate, tripled the highest rate, and it went into effect retroactively to the January 1 of 1932. There was no withholding tax at that time. Everyone had to pay their entire taxes on March 15th of the following year.
When they were already really, really suffering and could barely eat.
That's correct. That is very much the case. And the run on the banks that our history has told us about time after time that occurred in 1932 when it was It was right at the beginning of March of 1932, as Hoover was about to leave office. That was because people were having to go to the bank and draw out their savings in order to pay the income taxes. And in that circumstance, it would draw down the capital of the banks and, of course, cause some banks to fail because all of the money not only had been pulled out of the private capital of companies, but then people having to pay this tremendous income tax increase retroactively, the banks, especially smaller ones, were in trouble. None of the big banks were in trouble, only the smaller ones that they wanted to put out of business. This was another move that the ruling elite wanted. They wanted the banking industry, the financing of particularly the middle class, to be depleted so that the financial sector would be much better controlled by the very big banks and the ruling elite.
That's all we have for today, folks. Be sure to tune in on Wednesday and hear the second part of this interview. You can also catch that at sarahwestall.com, or you can hear this first interview or this first part of the interview at sarahwestall.com too, or the 100 other places the podcast is available, also on YouTube. Be sure to buy his book, and you can't learn everything through one interview. There's so much depth and detail here. The Fruits of Graft, you can get it at Amazon. It's both in Kindle and hardback versions. And I also want to encourage you to please support the program on Patreon. For as little as a dollar a day, you get my first two ebooks for free. A dollar a month. And for $2, you can get all of my ebooks for free. It's a very small amount to support the program. I know that everybody's asking for money, so how can you be giving me money too? So I'm hoping the books are in exchange, and other things that I give will at least bring you enough value to warrant spending that additional money that you work hard for. So I hope you have an amazing day.